It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear from a fitness specialist who works to help seniors live a healthy and active lifestyle.
First, the president of the University of Missouri announced today that he's resigning from his position.
Many organizations at that university, including the Student Association, football team, and several academic departments, called for University President Tim Wolf to step down. The calls came in the midst of growing racial tensions at the university. They prompted a hunger strike, several student and faculty demonstrations, and some students on the football team threatened not to participate in any football-related activities until Wolf resigned.
Jason Rosenbaum is with us to talk about the news of Tim Wolf's resignation. He's a political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we said today, Tim Wolf resigning in the midst of student and faculty protests. Back us up a little bit and tell us how we got here.
Well, you actually have to back up, I think, a couple of months. There were several highly publicized racial incidents at the University of Missouri that were high profile locally. There were several African-American students who testified that they were the subject of racial slurs, and there was a swastika drawn on a residence hall wall in the form of with human waste, to put it mildly. And these incidents kind of brought back, I think, some memories of Mizzou's past, which have not been the most progressive racially. And many of the African-American students at Mizzou wanted the administration to address these situations a lot more forcefully. They didn't believe that the university system president, Tim Wolf, was taking it seriously enough, and it sparked protests and a hunger strike and eventually today his resignation.
Now, he was under, as you say, some pressure to resign. Primarily, where was that pressure coming from?
I think it was coming from both the students and the faculty, as well as some political leaders in the state. While many of the statewide officials like Governor Jay Nixon or U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill did not explicitly call for him to resign, they were weighing in more, especially after the football team got involved. And there were actually members of both political parties within the legislature who had called for Wolf's resignation. And they not only cited the recent incidents involving race and African-American students' treatment there, but also other things that had piled up under his tenure involving other things as well. So he had been under fire from some lawmakers for his management of the four-campus system, and much of that disappointment among legislators came to a head over the last few days.
Now, you talked about a student who was undergoing a hunger strike. I think maybe today was day 7 or something like that. Now, that's a technique that has been used in protests throughout history in various times. It hasn't been used. It's not commonly used today. How effective was that particular technique in putting pressure on the administration?
Well, it certainly got attention locally within the Columbia, Missouri media, but I don't think it got attention nationally until it was linked to the football team coming out and saying, we're not going to play until Wolf is gone, and the student, Jonathan Butler, I believe is his name, his health and safety is kind of brought to the forefront. So I think it was a technique to bring a lot of these protests to the forefront and get the football team's attention for sure. And I think that a lot of people were legitimately concerned with his health and well-being. And I since he went, as you said, 7 days without eating, I think it was definitely effective. His health and safety is kind of brought to the forefront. So
we're talking to Jason Rosenbaum, political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio right now. We're talking about the resignation of Tim Wolf, president of the University of Missouri, after students protested his handling of racism on campus. And one of the main players in the story is an organization called Concerned Students 1950. Tell us a little bit about this group and what the name means.
Well, the name harkens back to the fact that the University of Missouri-Columbia did not admit its first African-American student or students until 1950. And there had been attempts for African-Americans to enter the university well before then, but they had been thwarted basically at every turn. And it kind of brings to mind both recent and past incident and a tough legacy with this university involving race. I went to the University of Missouri from 2002 to 2006, and there was a protest in 2004 over a column in the student newspaper that was seen as very disparaging against African-American students. And not only were they protesting that column, but they were also protesting how they felt minority and African-American students were treated there at the time. They felt that they weren't represented well. They felt like their presence there wasn't as welcomed as other students. And that happened again in 2010. That happened in the late 1960s. It's been a long history, I believe, of racial tensions at the University of Missouri-Columbia, both outwardly through protests and just from interactions with everyday students. I'm not saying that it happened on an everyday basis, but it certainly happened at times enough to where people noticed it and people were uncomfortable and took action about it. So the name that you mentioned, Concerned Student 1950, harkens back to a lot of that discomfort that was from many decades ago, but also recently.
That's interesting. What you're describing is really sort of a continuous history off and on of troubled race relations at this university. Had the university administration over the years been perceived as being effective at improving things?
Well, I when I was there, the University of Missouri assistant president was Elson Floyd, who passed away a few months ago, and he was the president of the Washington State University when he passed away. But at the time, when he was UM system president in the 2000s, he was seen as fairly popular and receptive and responsive to students. He didn't. His tenure was not without controversy for other reasons, but one of the reasons he was not controversial is he went out of his way to make sure that he had a direct contact with student leaders and everyday students about their concerns, and that made him very popular among the student body. Now, I don't know the internal machinations with Tim Wolf in this instance, but it was pretty evident that those connections had not been made in this instance. And for some people, the connection between administration and students may seem tertiary when a lot of the focus is on research and growing the institution. But in this instance, it's very, very important when dealing with explosive situations and a climate with a lot of racial tension. So I guess what I'm trying to say is in the past, especially when I was there, I think that there was a more receptive era between students and administration. And it seems that with these recent events, that trust and that bond had eroded over a many number of months and years.
Now, a lot of the times when you see these big institutional crises, there is more than one resignation that ends up happening down the road. Do you think that Tim Wolf will be the only one, or do you expect to see others follow?
I think the next big question is whether the chancellor of the University of Missouri-Columbia, Bowen Lofton, is the next person to go. And what's interesting to me is the UM system president does not actually handle the day-to-day operations of the campuses. He's mainly almost a figureheadish person that sets the leadership and overall strategy for the four campus systems. The chancellors are the ones that handle the day-to-day operations. And I think that the next person to experience a lot of pressure to go is the person who's in charge of Mizzou, the University of Missouri, and that's Lofton. He'd already been under fire for other reasons, for his handling of a very controversial situation with Planned Parenthood and how the university supplied medical professionals for a nearby facility. He's also done some other things that have made faculty really upset. And this happened under his watch, and I think there's going to be pressure now for him to step aside. But he has a lot of fans in the legislature, just as Tim Wolf had some people that liked him and didn't like him. So it'll remain to be seen whether he survives this.
Now, the story of racial tensions at the University of Missouri, it's been developing against a bigger backdrop of the national Black Lives Matter movement going on for the past year plus. How does this story fit into that larger context as we wrap up?
I think it there's no way to talk about this type of story without talking about the protests in Ferguson or New York or Baltimore. I think it's definitely raised the consciousness of how African Americans are treated not only in, you know, urban and suburban settings, but also on campus. And not only just from how they deal with police, but also how they deal in college settings. So Well, I don't think they're the exact correlated situations. I know that Butler, for example, protested in Ferguson and was inspired by the activism there. And I think it goes part and parcel with that overall movement of Black Lives Matter.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jason Rosenbaum, political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. He joined us to talk about the resignation today of Tim Wolf, president of the University of Missouri. He resigned after students protested his handling of racism on campus.
A group of older bicyclists stay fit and enjoy the outdoors each week by riding one of the many bike trails in the greater Milwaukee area. Nancy Camden recorded a 32-mile ride on the interurban trail with the Pedal Pals of Ozaukee County.
I'm pumping up my bike, Agnes Grogan.
How long have you been with the group?
Maybe 10 years.
We've all aged since the beginning of this group. I'll be 86 in spring. Last week I went riding for three different days and I put on 104 miles. My name is Don Ertel and I live in Cedarburg.
Eve Dicker-Eisman. Pedal Pals meets every Wednesday and then we bike for a couple of hours. We have lunch, talk, sometimes we do a little sightseeing, and then we come back.
Okay, let's go. Have a good time.
We all kind of keep together.
So we're riding right now on the interurban trail. Your wife does not bicycle?
No, she has bad knees. So do I. I have two new knees, but they work, I guess, for this.
Have you ever wiped out on your bike?
Yes. I cracked three ribs, tore a hole in my lung. My clavicle is still out of joint.
Did you have any fear of getting back on the bike after that?
No, you don't want to give up. Biking is fun.
Sometimes when I think it's too cool or it's going to rain, they're out there. Kind of gives you hope as a person who wants to keep on biking. When you're in a group, you should have a flat or get tired. There's always somebody there so you don't feel like you're alone.
May I ask how old you are?
I'm 79 next month.
It's a different ride every week.
Every week.
We're in Utsburg, a very family-friendly restaurant, and we're all sitting around the table here talking about experiences. My name is Chuck Schmidt. I've only been riding with this group for about a year.
Did you ride a bike before this?
I hadn't ridden a bike since I was a kid.
We nicknamed ourselves originally the SOB Bikers.
What's that mean?
Some older bikers. Bob Jacobs. I will be 85 in a couple months.
Marilyn Jacobs, and I will be 83, and we are both riding, as of this year, electric assist bikes. You still have to pedal, but it makes it possible for us to keep up with everybody else.
Well, it looks like everybody's off. Back to Port Washington.
Let's go. My name's Ron Heinrichs, and I live in Thiensville. Next week, we're going from Greenfield Park, and we're going south along the Root River. It's just wonderful that we all can make these rides. Because it's challenging, you ride 30 miles in a day. As you say, we're not kids anymore, but you can do it. When you learn how to ride a bike, it stays with you forever.
Beautiful, sunshiny day.
It's great to be alive and be outdoors.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Biking is just one way for seniors to stay active here in Wisconsin. There are a lot more options available, like our next guest program, a senior fitness program, this one in the Madison area.
Joining us now is Gino Leary, fitness specialist for the Goodman Rotary 50 Plus Fitness Program, offered through Madison School and Community Recreation. Gene, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So why do you think it's important for people to focus on fitness after the age of 50?
Well, I think it's important for people to focus on fitness pretty much throughout their lives, but for older adults, it also means independence. That's sort of a critical thing as you get a little bit older, and the more fit you are, the more likely you are to enjoy your later years.
I imagine you'll have people showing up, who, some of whom have been exercising maybe since their high school sporting experience, some who are maybe just taking this on now. Is it important to kind of tailor what people do to how much exercise they've been getting so far, what they're ready for?
Absolutely. And people, as you can imagine, have different things that they want to try. We've got quite a range of classes, and if you can imagine that age group from 50 to 90 or 100, let's say, they all have different needs, and some people go to a lower level gentle exercise class, and some people are in these quite active classes with strength and balance and agility, and it's taught in a big gym with lots of equipment. But everybody has sort of a starting point, you're right, and they need to kind of find out where they fit into the puzzle.
Well, there has been this big cultural push to get Americans more active, and this isn't just for the 50-plus crowd, but have you seen an uptick of interest in that age group?
We have, certainly, and I think a lot of it has to do with the demographics. As you can imagine, there are a lot of older adults, and I think what we really need to do is sort of develop some supportive mechanisms for people to actually do that. So my program is to be supportive in people's efforts to get moving and keep moving, and it could be anything from a walking club or cycling, like we just heard about, to these more active classes. But I think you have to kind of provide for everybody's needs. There's a lot of people with arthritis, so we have arthritis-based classes and instructors who are specially trained to deliver those kinds of classes.
For someone coming in who is just maybe getting exercising for the first time or the first time in a long time, what kind of things should they think about when picking that first exercise program?
Well, we encourage people to come and visit a class. I think you can learn a lot from watching people. I always tell people we're trying to help you, we're not trying to kill you, so come and watch and see what that simple weight training class is all about, and then you can make some decisions about what sorts of things you want to choose to do. But a simple weight training class is a really good starting thing. We do have walking clubs that I think kind of get people moving and socialized a little bit, and then they decide, oh, maybe I can move into something a little bit different. We have stretch and strength classes where you're not doing a lot of moving, but you are getting stronger and more flexible as you go.
We're talking with Gene O'Leary right now, fitness specialist for the Goodman Rotary 50 Plus Fitness Program, talking about staying active after the age of 50. And Gene, what would you say to people who might be kind of intimidated about taking some of these classes? They're worried maybe that they're going to be the one person in the class who's out of shape, or that the instructor is going to be super buff with six-pack abs and they won't be able to keep up. So what do you tell people like that who just have some concerns?
Well, again, to come and watch the class, I think, is an important piece of that. And also, I always tell people we've got people that are 90-plus years old doing yoga. And I think you kind of have to see that to believe it. But, again, everybody has a starting point, and it might be something as simple as a gentle exercise class where there's always chairs available. You can make some decisions based on what sort of class you want to choose based on the class descriptions. We've got quite a wide variety of those. And I think people really just coming to watch the class for the first time is real important. And we sometimes have free classes when we start the session so that people can try it out.
The medical community in Wisconsin and beyond has been focusing a lot on preventing falls among seniors because that can lead to broken bones and a lot of negative health consequences. What kind of exercise programs are there that might help with fall prevention?
I'm actually on the Dane County Falls Prevention Task Force. It's a really big problem in Wisconsin for a lot of different reasons, and exercise is one of the components that can really help. So in the popular press, you'll see things about Tai Chi, just getting a little bit stronger in your lower body, and then practicing very specific balance exercises that we know from the evidence base that are actually good for people that should be in their sort of day-to-day program. So we have a wonderful class called Balancing Act. We've got one called Core and Balance Combo. A lot of the strength exercises are aimed specifically at working on strength one leg at a time, trying to get people just really a little more functional.
And do you think that that's a good place to start with some of those balance classes if you do only one class? Would you recommend that?
I would actually recommend a strength training class for starters. As odd as it sounds and as intimidating as that might sound, a simple stretch and strength class really goes a long way for you to sort of uncover what those deficiencies are. And it lets an instructor kind of see, well, where can I start with this person? These are all group fitness classes, so it's a little hard initially to get everybody into the right mix, but we have a class called Simple Strength and Gentle Exercise, and those are sort of meant as starter classes for people that are just starting out.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for talking today.
Sure, you're welcome.
Jean O'Leary is a fitness specialist for the Goodman Rotary 50 Plus Fitness Program in Madison.
GOP presidential hopefuls are in Wisconsin this week for a primary debate in Milwaukee, with issues related to the economy front and center this time around.
But a pastor and community leader is asking the question, do presidential candidates have a plan for urban America?
That question is especially pressing for Milwaukee, which has seen well over 100 homicides this year.
Joining us now to talk more about the state of urban America is E.W. Jackson, president and CEO of the Stand Foundation and founder and senior pastor of the Called Church. Bishop Jackson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why do you think the state of America's cities and urban areas hasn't been a big talking point in the presidential race so far this year?
Well, it's puzzling to me because we have, for the last year, faced all kinds of conflagrations, riots, major problems with police-community relations, and a spike in murders. Clearly, the unemployment rate in the inner cities of America is running way higher than it is for the rest of the country. So there are major problems. And frankly, part of what we're doing is trying to make sure that it gets on the agenda as part of the debate. Right? We've been struggling with these issues for 50 years. I think we can solve them if there is a concerted effort and a will on the part of our public officials and, of course, the corporate community.
Now, you say you've been struggling to get it on the agenda. How do you hope to accomplish that?
Well, look, we've got a project called Project CREATE, Cultural Renewal, Economic Awakening, and Technical Education. It's a private sector program to rescue America's inner cities. And basically what we talk about is going into the inner cities and trying to deal particularly with younger people who have not yet gotten involved in the criminal justice system and gangs. And, of course, some who have as well, but trying to preempt that and give them a sort of a different vision for what to do with their lives that would include dealing with some of the cultural issues. And when I say cultural issues, I mean issues, for example, like, well, if you're black and you speak proper English, you're trying to be white. If you're trying to do well academically, you're trying to be white. Or, for example, having babies and not taking care of them is okay. It's not okay. These children are ultimately going to grow up and end up in the same cycle of poverty and crime, often as the father that fathered them and abandoned them. That's often his problem. And so these children end up perpetuating that same way of life. So we want to address some of these issues in the inner city, and we believe that the government has failed miserably in doing that, and it's too bureaucratic and has got too many limitations based on religion and values and this, that, and the other, that we need a private sector effort to go in and try to break this intergenerational poverty and crime and gangs and drugs and violence that's happened to the inner city.
Now, obviously, a lot of pressing issues for the presidential candidates to be talking about. There's immigration reform, national security, ISIS. How do you make the case that against a backdrop like that, that the problems that you're talking about there, problems of urban America, need to be higher up on the agenda?
Well, we all want our economy to grow. How do we think our economy is going to fare if we end up with major upheaval and disorder in our cities across America? I think every single one of us, when things erupted in Ferguson, when they erupted in Baltimore, they erupted in Oakland, every single one of us was thinking, could this start to spread across the country? Are we going to have a major problem in our cities? You know, Dr. King used to talk about the fierce urgency of now, and he would say either America addresses these problems now in a non-violent atmosphere, or it will address them later in a violent atmosphere of upheaval. And, of course, Dr. King also proved to be right about that. So I think we need to take preemptive action and make these inner cities part of our economic plan for the country so that we can all prosper, not just those who don't live in urban America, but all of us.
Now, Bishop Jackson, you said that you feel that the government has failed at this in the past, and you're looking for a private sector solution. Why do you want the private sector to take this on?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is, obviously, there's a major economic component to this. There are not enough jobs, obviously, in the inner city, often almost none. Small businesses have a very hard time surviving in the inner city because of the high levels of crime. What are we going to do to provide jobs for those people? You know, 80% of the American people, depending on what study you look at, but it's anywhere between 70 and 80% of the American people work in small businesses. How many small businesses are there in the inner city to employ the people who live there? Precious few. So an economic program to save the inner city that is self-perpetuating, that becomes its own engine of growth, has to be based on the private sector, because we know what happens when you start doing government programs. The money runs out, the politics for spending that money runs out, and when that happens, things just go right into reversal. So I think it's time for us to look at a major Marshall Plan that is based in private sector principles and private sector involvement and partnerships.
We're talking right now with Pastor E.W. Jackson about why the state of America's cities hasn't been a bigger topic in politics and what he hopes to hear from the presidential candidates. And looking at that private sector solution that you're thinking about there, given that this is not a government solution you're looking for, but something emanating from the private sector, what do you want the next president to do to support that?
I want the next president to lead. I think that's the most important thing the next president can do. You know, President Obama is famous for having said, I have a pen and I have a phone. And look, what he said was absolutely true. What he was saying was the presidency has immense power and influence. And if the president of the United States says, look, we've got to do something about the major problems that are faced by families and individuals in the inner city. I mean, think about the things that have happened across the country, the young children who have been killed in gang crossfire, the young mothers, the grandmothers who've just been killed, just innocently going about their business, but they're caught up in the middle of this violence that is taking place. We've got to put a stop to that. We talk about what's happening and the people who are suffering in the Middle East. Well, our own people are suffering in our own inner cities. The president can provide leadership. He can call these companies together. They will answer his call, and he will say, you guys and gals have innovation, you have resources, you have business knowledge and savvy. You can go into these inner cities. You can mentor some of these small business people. You can help some of these young people to understand that their future could be an entrepreneurship, that they can, in fact, earn a very comfortable living, perhaps even become wealthy, doing legitimate things in the private sector. They've got to be shown those opportunities. These things have to be modeled for them. I think the president gives that word and follows up on it, I think we'd see some very, very serious action. Of course, he's not the only one, because people like me are, and I've got a network of ministers across the country, and we are all now starting to talk about this. But in my view, it will take presidential leadership.
Now, as a general rule of thumb, big cities are more likely to vote Democratic. So what does that mean for getting both parties interested in solving the problems that you're laying out for urban America?
You know, I'll be very honest. I could really care less about that right now. I'm concerned about the fact that, you know, these young people are living lives of hopelessness and despair. instead of enjoying all the opportunities that are available in our country. They're often stuck in a dead end, and we've got to come together and show them a way out. And I don't care, frankly, whether Republicans or Democrats do it. I just care that we do something effective, and I think it ought to be something that we can all come together on. You know, Republicans are accused of not caring about the poor, not caring about minorities. Democrats are accused, at least by Republicans and conservatives, of just wanting to spend money and not caring whether you're actually being effective in helping people. I think, frankly, that on both sides, there are sincere people who really would like to do something effective, but haven't been able to agree on what that is. Maybe a private sector approach is something that everybody can get behind. And when we begin to see results, you know, kids doing better educationally, more jobs being produced, more people getting involved in entrepreneurial activity in the inner city. When we begin to see that, I think that's something we'll all applaud. And you know, Ronald Reagan used to say, at least it's attributed to him, you know, it's amazing what can get done when nobody cares who gets the credit.
We're talking right now with Bishop E.W. Jackson about why the state of America's cities hasn't been a bigger talking point in politics and what he's hoping to hear in the presidential election.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think the presidential candidates need to talk more about American cities? What do you think would be the best way to boost the economy, reduce crime rates in big cities? Do any of the candidates stick out to you as having a good plan for America's cities? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our guest says the presidential candidates haven't been talking enough about how to improve America's cities.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think the presidential candidates need to talk more about cities, about urban issues? What do you want to hear from them? What issues are most important to urban America? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we continue the conversation now with E.W. Jackson, President and CEO of the Stand Foundation. And we'll go to our callers right now at 800-642-1234. We go to Dan in La Crosse. Dan, hi.
Hi. I've heard Donald Trump, and I believe it was Ben Carson, talk about putting more factories in inner cities in the U.S. We have trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's one coming up in with Europe. Why are we sending jobs overseas when we have unemployed minority people in our inner cities? Also, I believe Sojourners.org had videos of some candidates talking about how they would deal with poverty.
Great. Well, thank you, Dan. Some good points there. So Dan's saying he's heard Donald Trump mention putting factories in inner cities. What do you think of that idea?
Well, look, I think it's a great idea. But frankly, I think more importantly, we need to create an entrepreneurial culture in the inner city. In other words, a self-generating engine of entrepreneurial and economic activity. I think the seed of it is already there. You know, putting factories in the inner city, of course, it's a great idea. How many factories are we going to be able to put in the inner city, given the fact that we're doing less and less manufacturing in our country, and we're doing more and more technology and that's the order of the day for our economy today. So many young people who have figured this out are getting technical education. Some of them getting them through community college. Some of them going to private technical schools, becoming systems engineers, becoming computer experts, and going out and earning a very, very good living. So, but my focus is on, frankly, technical education, giving people skills that are actually marketable and saleable in the free market. So, but look, I'm certainly not against factories. But here again, notice, these trade agreements do tend to move jobs offshore, and of course, the people who are suffering the worst from unemployment are people in the inner city. Illegal immigration tends to get those low-level, entry-level jobs that are often taken up by illegal immigrants. Who's affected most by that? People in the inner city. So look, they're really part of the debate, even if they're not mentioned. And I would say one last thing. It's one thing to say, well, we need to put factories in the inner city. That's not a plan. We need a plan. We need to know how are we going to, over the next 4 years, 8 years, decade, two decades, look back and say, okay, we finally solved, essentially solved the problem of inner city poverty, violence, dislocation, chaos, family breakdown. I think we as Americans can do that, but we've got to have the will and we've got to have a plan.
And before we go to our next caller, you're calling for a plan. And earlier you mentioned something that would look like a Marshall Plan for cities. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that might look like?
Sure. I'll give you the broad outlines. We haven't released the entire thing to the public yet, but it's called Project CREATE. It's a three-pronged approach: cultural renewal, economic awakening, and technical education. The cultural renewal part deals with this whole issue of family. You know, family breakdown, no matter what side of the political spectrum you come from or you view things from, family breakdown is clearly a major problem. It clearly contributes to the social dislocation. It clearly contributes to crime. It clearly contributes to unemployment, to drug addiction, to drug use, to drug sales. We've got to break that, and that's not going to happen overnight. The government has proved it can't do it, but I think churches and community groups and organizations working in the community can begin to break that cycle, that thinking. So we need cultural renewal, and that's a big part of it, restoring the strength of families in the inner city. And then, of course, we need economic awakening. You know, I'm convinced that most Americans, and this certainly includes Americans in the inner city, are economically illiterate in terms of how capitalism works. And I'm not talking about whether you agree with it ideologically or whether you love it or you hate it. We do work in this country primarily through a capitalist system. People need to understand it, need to understand how it works. And I said the people who best understand how capitalism works in the inner city are drug dealers. Because they know that if you have a product that people want and you put it on the market and make it available, they'll come running to get it. Well, we need to turn that kind of energy and understanding. First, we need to expand it, but we need to turn it to a positive use and start getting people economically awakened to the power of capitalism and the power of entrepreneurship. And then technical education, I said a little earlier, we need to stop focusing so much on teaching people esoteric subjects, which they can learn on their own if they choose to. We need to start focusing on getting people technically educated so that they're prepared to be computer specialists, prepared to be engineers, for that matter, prepared to be plumbers or carpenters. You name it, any host of things. We have a shortage right now of technically skilled laborers. Ask anybody who tries to find a plumber, tries to find a carpenter, tries to find somebody to do the sorts of home repairs that are short of, you know, building a house, and they'll tell you it's tough to find them.
We're talking to E.W. Jackson right now, president and CEO of the Stand Foundation. We're talking about urban issues and the presidential race, and we're going to go to a caller next. We've got Robert joining us in Green Bay. Robert, hi.
Hi. I'm having a little now differences. I disagree with some of the things your caller is saying. I believe that some of the number one things that we need to do and we need to work on is urban renewal. Like you take the city of Detroit, for example, I have yet to even hear President Obama say that he's going to do anything in his, you know, two tenures now with cities like Detroit, holding landowners and landlords responsible, holding city governments and officials responsible for the way that their cities are being ran. Detroit is just one example. There are several cities like Detroit all over the United States of America. And I think if we were to build those areas up and have some people, first of all, have a home and have some pride and pride in their neighborhoods, and then maybe the companies would want to come work there, and people would have that, you know, good foundation and the good roots, if you will, to then say, okay, I do want to go on to school. I feel safe in my neighborhoods. I feel comfortable in my neighborhoods.
All right, Robert, thank you so much for your comments there. And Bishop Jackson, how do we hold people responsible for what's going on in the cities? How do we hold governments and officials responsible, city governments?
Well, we've tried top down, and it hasn't worked. That's my point. I don't know what he disagrees with me. I mean, I agree with his assessment of where the cities are. I just don't agree that the federal government can come in and somehow change things by taking the land and seeing to it that it's developed. I mean, in effect, all you're doing is putting a Band-Aid on the problem. As you know, we saw this when we first began to build public housing, and everybody thought, oh, this is the answer. This is going to be great. And now we got public. And, of course, it turned out to be a jungle infested with all kinds of crime and difficulties for the people who lived there, even though it started out as a wonderful idea. We've got to do it from the bottom up. We've got to begin to build people up. Somebody else wants to do something from that level, I just think government has failed, but somebody else wants to do something from that level, not going to find me standing in their way. But we've got to build from the bottom up and really begin to rebuild the culture of these communities so that they can generate the jobs and the economic activity on their own.
Now, a couple of things that are entangled in the issues that you're talking about now. One you mentioned already, police-community relations is important, and also criminal justice reform. Are you accounting for things like this in your new plan?
Absolutely. That's part of it. First of all, let's face it, police-community relations could be a lot better if there were ongoing communications between police and members of the community, and why that does not happen, I'm not sure. So what we end up with is relationships based on anecdotes and based on incidents rather than the broad swath of what happens in police-community relations. The reality is most police are doing their job and doing it effectively, and they're trying to combat crime in a very high-crime area, particularly in the inner cities. And the good citizens of those places have got to get together with the police and work together and work this out. So that's part of our cultural renewal program, respect for authority. Of course, police need to respect the rights of citizens, of course, but those young people need to respect authority and not try to fight with the police and be disrespectful toward them. It's going to take community leadership to do that. But, yes, that's part of it. And criminal justice does need reform. I am not convinced that every person who goes to jail for using drugs, I'm a pastor, I've got people in my church who committed drug offenses and ended up with records, and that is a major problem. I'm concerned about that. But because they were not violent offenders, they never saw any time, or at least they didn't do serious time, sometimes hell, that sort of thing. But I think that putting felonies on people and leaving those felonies there decade after decade when the person is gainfully employed, living a decent, law-abiding life, I think that's extremely debilitating, and that's one of the things that's hurting the inner city. And, yeah, that's an issue that we want to address.
And just briefly here as we wrap up, you're looking for more conversation about this at the national level, including from the presidential candidates. And you said that the candidate who comes up with a unifying vision to help cities will probably win in November. What makes you say that?
Well, look, I really believe that we've come to a point after 8 years as the first black president of the United States, when people realize that they don't have any more jobs, their income is down, poverty is up, that it really hasn't changed anything. I think people are really looking for the leader who comes along with a vision that they believe will actually help them. And I think whether that person's a Republican or a Democrat, I think people are going to respond to it. And I think that could turn the tide of the election, particularly in these battleground states like Ohio, Virginia, Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, some of these other places where the urban vote could make a big difference. So I'll be waiting to see what candidate offers that kind of vision.
Bishop Jackson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was E.W. Jackson, president and CEO of the Stand Foundation, talking about urban issues and the presidential race.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.